This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
Welcome, dear listeners, to another episode of Urban Political. Today, we will be discussing Colin McFarlane's recent book, Waste and the City, The Crisis of Sanitation and Right to City Life, that has recently been published with Verso. Colin has been a guest on our podcast previously in an episode where we discussed his book, Fragments of the City. So to discuss Colin's book today, we are joined by two excellent guests, Vanessa Castambroto and Julia Wesley, who I will introduce in a moment. I would like to introduce the book author, Colin McFarlane, first. Colin is a professor at the Department of Geography at Durham University. His work focuses on the experience of politics of the city, exploring how cities are known, lived, and politicized, particularly on the economic margins. He examines urban living, densities, fragments, and learning across different cities. His current projects include the production, experience, and perception of densities in cities, supported by a European Research Council Consolidator Grant. He's the author of several books, including Fragments of the City, Making and Remaking of Urban Worlds, published by University of California Press in 2021, Learning the City, Knowledge and Translocal Assemblage, Blackwell, and he has edited multiple collections on urbanism as well. His work has been supported by the Leverhulme Prize and several ESRC projects. Our first interlocutor, Vanessa Castambroto, is a professor for climate urbanism at the Department of Geography, University of Sheffield. Vanessa joined the Urban Institute at the University of Sheffield in September 2017, following her appointment as a professorial fellow in the Faculty of Social Sciences. Research has been funded by the British Academy, Leverhulme Trust, ESRC, ESRC, and the Institution of Civil Engineers. In 2016, she received the Philip Leverhulme Prize for contributions to geography. In 2013, she received a United Nations Award for lighthouse activities that contribute to fighting climate change with a focus on the urban poor. Thanks for joining us today. And last but not least, Julia Wesley is an interdisciplinary researcher with a BSc in Environment and Natural Resource Management from the University of Life Sciences in Vienna, and an MSc in Ecosystem Governance and Globalization from Stockholm University. Her work at Austrian and Swiss research institutes has focused on local governance, disaster, and risk management, and the role of collaboration and participatory processes in achieving sustainable, just, and climate-compatible development. During her PhD studies at the Development Planning Unit, she explored these issues in Manizales in Colombia, where managing a range of risks has become a strategic factor in urban development. Julia's research underscores the importance of participatory processes and local governance in fostering sustainable urban environments. So thanks for making the time to introduce and discuss this important piece of work by Colin for our listeners. I would like to begin with Vanessa. I would like to invite you to make a short commentary on Colin's book, Vanessa.
Thank you very much, Nitin. And thank you very much, Colin, for this fantastic book. I think the best way to celebrate a book is compare it with another very great book. So I'm pretty sure you would all recognize the great existential play by Samuel Beckett, Waiting for Godot, and as a meditation of life meaning and how we lose meaning when we stop seeking the transcendental answers given by external institutions like society or religion. And the whole play is about these two characters, Vladimir and Estragon, who are waiting for Godot, which is that thing or that person that will reveal the whole meaning of their existence. But then when they are facing enslavement and injustice, one of them, Vladimir, exclaims, I have to read this, "Let us not waste our time in idle discourse. Let us do something while we have the chance. It is not every day that we are needed. Not indeed that we are personally needed. Others will meet the case equally well, if not better. To all humankind, they were addressed, those cries for help is still ringing in our ears. But at this place, at this moment of time, all humankind is with us, whether we like it or not. Let us make the most of it before it is too late. Let us represent worthily, for once, the full broad to which the cruel fate consigned us. What do you say? And to this cry for action and for movement, his friend Estragon responds nothing. And then Vladimir loses courage and then says, it is true that when with folded arms we weigh the pros and cons, we are not less a credit to our species. And then he says, well, that is not the question. What are we doing here? That is the question. And we are blessed in this, that we happen to know the answer. Yes, in this immense confusion, one thing alone is clear. We are waiting for Godot to come. And in that waiting, they seem lost. Because life's meaning, the lesson that Vladimir and Estragon never seem to learn, is intrinsically linked to action, not to waiting for someone or something else to tell you how to live or how to address injustice, wherever it happens. So I thought of these very contradictions, all these meanings, in Waiting for Godot while reading Collins Waste and the City, particularly as he starts telling those stories about Mumbai and then moves all over through all these communities from Kampala to Karachi to South Africa. And in all those communities, the political demands, they're always unmet. And then there is this question is, what are we going to do? How are we going to respond to this? Are we just going to wait? And the truth is that most of these communities, what is common across all these contexts is that many of these these communities feel abandonment by institutions or by other actors, but it's this willful neglect, sometimes the active destruction of the sanitation facilities, even their housing, or the enrollment of sanitation responses in inaccessible markets. Is this abandonment that is a sign? Is this almost need to occupy that empty space of abandonment and wait? But Collins' proposal is a different one. It's one of affirmative sanitation, which involves demand for sanitation for all, and which, according to the book, begins from the position that sanitation is this fundamental right that underpins the wider experience of living in the city. So it is from that perspective that I really like how the book goes and says, well, affirmative sanitation can only be understood in relation to city life and to living. And I think for Collins, city life is this way of reimagining the right to the city, but it moves away because it focuses on how the city is inhabited, and also on the possibility of joining that urban life in one's own terms, which resonates very much with the literature on the right to the city. So I particularly like this kind of relationship between city life and the need to move away from imaginaries that kind of stop and constrain that city life, and that almost puts city life in that impasse of waiting for something external or something else to give us meaning. For example, I particularly like when Colin talks about moving away from the imaginary of backward marginal slums and how that imaginary is paralyzing. And in fact, Colin says that we should really see those things in a much more simpler way because they are just simply neighborhoods, right? They are, and this a quote from the book, places where people live all kinds of lives, ups and downs, struggles and ventures, places of urban culture, politics and sociality, and in short, of city life. I prefer to describe such places, typically on the economic margins of the urban world, as low-income neighborhoods where urban majorities increasingly live. And I really like, Colin, that you felt that you had to introduce this critique of this imaginary of the slum, even before you define city life, because it's so fundamental, the need to kind of move from away from that impasse. This is not time to wait. This is the time where we are going to act. And sanitation responses within this prism of city life are become varied and diverse and become like emerging from different places and different origins. But in every case, they are inserted within the ebbs and flows that characterize that city life. not as punctual interventions, but as you say, as networked struggles within situated histories of urban dispossession. You describe sanitation as this continuous spatial conflict and as related with a number of desires and a number of really difficult relationships that we have in our societies and in our emotions. And sometimes sanitation moves from the psychological to the very political and social, and through these ideas of shame, blame, disgust, and they're all strong emotions that are all embedded in this powerful city life. And in fact, I mean, through the book, you tell so many stories, but particularly compelling these stories of collapsing toilets and how they become a powerful reminder of sanitation as an existential challenge. So in the end, I felt that the most persuasive argument that you make is that this idea of claiming the small pipe as a realm of intervention for those communities that are done with the waiting. Those examples from the Orange pilot project, or the story of CCI in Dar es Salaam, the stories from Mumbai. I really liked this idea of what is the place, what is the how our relationship with the material is going to shape what we can do, how we can move forward. But I also am very mindful that you write at the end, the underbelly of the community solution rhetoric is blame, exploitation, and abandonment. Let's say sanitation in the end is maybe in the planning language, a wicked problem that requires a collective commitment to understanding and justice, but there's not an easy answer. So I don't know, I was thinking of what questions could be interesting to ask that, I didn't want to ask you questions that you already answered in the book, and the book is comprehensive and self-contained, but perhaps the most obvious question is, what does it mean to call sanitation a universal right? Does calling it a universal right impose a particular outlook of living within legalistic frameworks? And is this a Western imposed framework? For example, when we talk about universal right, I mean, and you discussed this a little bit, does it impose a judgmental view on open defecation? To what extent does this universalist aspiration of the universal right to sanitation challenge your state aim of recognizing different needs and aspirations? For example, you give these examples in which community-led total sanitation has led to divisive policies and to the exclusion of different groups in places like Ethiopia. And also, of course, how a lot of this also relies on the mobilization of contradictory emotions, such as shame, disgust, and fear. Another issue is this paying for toilets. There are several examples about paying for toilets, but very often it comes as something that is negative, and the idea that we shouldn't pay for toilets. And however, in the book, there are examples, and we know all examples, in which paying for toilets is perhaps the only way to maintain a decent sanitation. So, for example, we know cases of toilets that are maintained by communities paying a collective fund or something, and that when those payments stop, then the whole project falls down. I mean, these communities themselves often tell you they are upset that their other community members have not paid for the toilets. So we all may agree that paying for peeing is not great, but I think are there situations where paying is the fairest option? Then the other, I really like the idea that you say that sanitation is a spatial network, and perhaps there is a need to state that. But I was wondering, are there really aspatial approaches to sanitation? I mean, who is doing them? Who is doing sanitation without looking at the space? Maybe it's sometimes it's the question of being more explicit about it and how we talk in policy, but like I find that really fascinating to think in my mind. Finally, perhaps I was wondering that I found that you were going through all these different struggles with sanitation as differentiated for women, children, workers, and refugees. But I was wondering, I mean, I know you know the intersectional approach and it's very central to a lot of things that you do, but I wonder whether having adopted a more explicit intersectional approach would have changed your analysis in some way and whether you've considered it. So those are my four questions. Thank you very much for such a fantastic book. It's such a pleasure to read.
Thanks, Vanessa. So I would like to invite Julia now.
Yeah, thank you, meeting Vanessa and Colin. Vanessa, I'm actually, I could have just continued listening to your arguments and starting from the very poetic comparison of the urgency to act. And I'm very curious to hear about Colin's responses as well. Thank you, Colin, for writing, for sharing the book, and Nitin for hosting the podcast and inviting me to it. I think, Nitin, you also mentioned at the beginning that it's not the first time that Colin's books are discussed on this podcast. But I think that it's especially fitting in a way for Waste in the City for two main reasons that I want to start with. So on the one hand, I think the fact that the global sanitation crisis still does not receive nowhere near the attention it deserves. And I'd say neither in politics nor in urban studies. And I think that book is really full of evidence to demonstrate that this form of kind of intentional or unintentional omission neglect has really severe repercussions, starting with just vast data gaps of very little that we know. But where data exists, we see this, you know, horrific statistics that you cite of globally more than half of the population lacking adequate sanitation. 1.5 million people died from diarrhea in 1 year in 2016, which is completely preventable disease. And then the macroeconomic perspective that unsafe sanitation costs around $223 billion per year due to the cost of illnesses, the lost productivity and wages. And then, as Vanessa already said, like you have all those stories to really narrate the everyday experiences of sanitation users, of sanitation workers, whose mental, physical health and overall life as urban citizens is just severely, you know, cut short, affected. So this is a massive crisis. But we don't, I think, publicly talk sufficiently about pits, about poo, about menstruation, about fecal sludge. It's not as center stage as it should. So, of course, I mean, there are, you know, many collectives and Colin and you're acknowledging them a lot in this book. That really try to break this taboo and overcome this stigma. But still, I think it's very important to have, you know, to have those kinds of conversations in a public forum. And the second aspect, which is why I find this conversation very pertinent, is because it's the urban political podcast. And that obviously then brings the political nature of the debate really, really upfront. We're talking about adequate sanitation, and we're not starting from the engineering solutions as a point of departure. You know, of how to build toilets, of how to connect everyone to the grid. And here, I think what the book really does beautifully is to talk about every scale and every level of politics, from this kind of like deeply gendered sanitation work at the household level to, you know, the accessibility, the adequacy of public toilets for people with different needs, to really the global political agendas and the definitions that they have in terms of, you know, what constitutes limited, what constitutes basic, or what constitutes safely managed toilets, and then how that translates into certain investment programs, how that translates into monitoring structures. And then, as Vanessa has already said, I think with framing sanitation as a right to city life, you really draw attention to, you know, who gets access, who has control over what, where, when, why, and under which conditions. So I'm just making these two, I think, very basic and very obvious points, but that this book is on sanitation, that it is written, that it is talked about publicly, and that it's done in a format that foregrounds the political nature of the sanitation crisis and the political nature of proposed solutions. I think that's, for me, I think, quite fundamental to start with. At that point, I think I just also wanted to clarify a bit of how I read the book. So on the one hand, I was lucky to be part of a research program called Overdue, Tackling the Sanitation Crisis Across Urban Africa, which was a UK-funded program led at University College London, and where we worked with NGOs and academic partners in seven African cities, in Beira, Bukavu, Antananarivo, Freetown, St. Louis, Abidjan, and Mwanza. And that project for me was, I think, on the one hand, really a deep dive in learning about the sanitation service chain with a feminist lens, and really also an eye-opener on all the tactics and the strategies that our partners explored to make the sanitation actually work. With that, I want to say that I'm like by no means a sanitation expert, but perhaps precisely because of that, I could be, you know, your target audience calling in that book, because it gets me as an urban researcher to, you know, to focus on, reflect on key issues that I have overlooked and think about how I could, you know, incorporate them a bit more intentionally into my research. where my second entry point is women researchers, is the question of how different urban practitioners learn the city. And here, obviously, Colin, your 2011 book on learning the city has been a key, you know, point of departure for me. And I really like thinking about how to link those two books and bring them into conversation. With this lens of learning the city, that I just wanted to point out two aspects that we perhaps could take forward to the discussion. And the first point is on your very first page, and that's Leslie Lowe's quote from the book No Place to Go, which is, "The every person goes to the bathroom 6 to 8 times a day. You do the math." And I think sanitation for me is really a prime example of the power of experiential and place-based learning. In the Overdue project, we also had a colleague from Mozambique who shared that people in rural areas, instead of saying, "I go to the toilet," use the phrase, "I'm going to do what no one else can do for me." I think he used this very poetic phrase of, you know, answering the call to nature to describe the same experience. And I'm sure if we, you know, go around the room, Nitin, Vanessa, you would have other expressions we kind of share to express this kind of like bodily experience that we all have in common. It is this kind of like what we have in common, what we do every day, where we can start to talk about adequate sanitation as a universal agenda. But where we can also, and that's the point that also Vanessa made, we can start to learn about the diversity of experiences. And here, I think your second chapter on people really show how these sanitation experiences are shaped by intersections of our identities. So the book describes the experiences of menstruating girls who skip school because of stigma and inadequate facilities, or of manual scavengers or pit emptiers who are paid below minimum wage, whose work is really dangerous and life-threatening, and who at the same time are deeply stigmatized. And I think what your analysis spells out very clearly to me is that these sanitation experiences cannot be seen to be separate from the wider context of structural inclusion, of marginalization of urban dwellers because of their gender, age, socioeconomic status, bodily ability, religious background, and so on. In the third chapter, where you focus on things like toilets, you say in the context of public toilets in the UK that the question of good access to decent toilets is not just a question of convenience, but one of belonging and citizenship. And that, I think, for me, cuts to the heart of the book in a way. So here also is where, for me, and that's the second point, the question of contestation arises, of voicing demands for increased commitment and for accountability to recognize and to materialize those sanitation rights and those rights to city life. So what resonated with me is obviously that chapter on collective action on protests, which made me also wonder about the collective learning processes that are behind these actions. In chapter 5, you talk about, you know, when human waste is used in protest in a situation where the activists really see no other political channel available. And you describe, on the one hand, how authorities in very different contexts from the US to South Africa have quickly responded by portraying protesters rather than the waste as dirty and disgusting, or performing this, what you call the discursive slippage from unclean places to unclean people, rather than acknowledging that the sanitation crisis is part of a wider critique of, you know, a state that is just unable to provide for the very basic services. And of course, here as well, if you're learning from and if you're learning through this politics of waste, that goes so much further than just the actual issue of sanitation. So we're learning about, I think, in this chapter about collective mobilization under even very highly repressive circumstances. So the question of menstrual activism or the prison protests that you're describing, where you say, and I quote, that the margins of the body and the margins of society become dramatized together, symbolically and materially, through a profoundly political sensorial shock tactic. So these protests, I think, this collective manifestation around a variety of sanitation issues, they make me wonder, and that's where I want to stop, about the network nature, not only of sanitation itself, but about the networks who are struggling for some form of sanitation justice. And whether and how, and that's my question that I would like to pose, your framing of sanitation as a right to city life could provide some form of renewed impetus or some reframing for movements, for networks like the ones you described with Slum and Checkwells International, for example, to converge and to strengthen their agendas.
Thanks a lot, Julia, for that. Colin, would you like to come in?
Yeah, great. Thanks, Nitin. Okay, thanks, Vanessa and Julia, for that. That was really fantastic and to listen to that, and just really grateful for the time we've spent, because we keep saying to each other right now, it's June, that it's a busy time of year, but it's always a busy time of year, so I really appreciate that you've taken the time to engage with the book. And it's really, it is genuinely kind of humbling to hear the kind of attention you've given to it. So thank you so much for that. I really appreciate it. And the comments are really helpful. Obviously, there's a lot to think about and, you know, that will go beyond our conversation here. So I'll try and make some responses, and then perhaps we can have some discussion around that if there's time. I'll start with, I guess, Vanessa, because Vanessa spoke first. Really interesting, really helpful. I mean, I think what you're saying about waiting and the question of waiting around, the question of waiting in relation to sanitation is just so fascinating, because, of course, there is a kind of social waiting that comes with the, as you said, abandonment of the provision of sanitation and indeed other vital infrastructures and services to communities all over the urban world. But there's also a kind of bodily urgency that comes with having to deal with sanitation. So there's a kind of a sort of daily reminder of the consequences of inequality, marginalization, historical oppression written into the body and written into the sort of texture of daily rhythms of moving around the city, moving around the neighborhood, going to work, going to school, and so on, which sits alongside this temporality of waiting, that kind of relation of the urgency of bodily needs and provisions with the kind of the sense of abandonment and waiting for the kind of always deferred promise of sanitation, I think is actually quite important in the book, but I didn't really sort of draw out or think about it very much as I was writing. So as you were speaking, that really resonated with me very strongly, and I'll keep thinking about that. So coming to your questions, I think the first question you asked about was, what does it mean to call sanitation a universal right? So this is interesting, this, because I think it's important, because it's, speaking personally, the work I've done, and you're both sort of kind enough to mention work I've done in the past, I've sort of strayed away from talking about cities in terms of universals, or to thinking about urbanism in terms of universals. And I've tended to be drawn more towards thinking around the contingencies, the sort of dynamism, the multiplicity, the kind of combinatory nature of urbanism, which is always producing new and different things, even in small ways, even amongst the routines and the habits and the reproductions of urban history. So I've not sort of been drawn, I've not really been drawn to the language of universals before in some other writing. But I felt quite strongly writing this book, what I was talking about here, you know, had to be described as a universal right. If there was anything about the urban problematic that was universal, it was the provision of basic provisions like toilets. And in fact, indeed, you know, probably there are, you know, if you want to think about the whole question of the good city, which I think sort of lurks in the background to this book, the good city surely must include certain universals. It must include universals to shelter. It must include universals to water and sanitation, to education, to the right to move unharassed, to the right not to be discriminated according to identity, religion, race, gender, and so on and so forth. There are a set of universals which I'm increasingly kind of thinking that we, you know, we just need to be sort of making this argument in kind of concrete terms. Of course, it's not the way in which you achieve a universal right is not itself universal. In the book, I try to explore different ways of thinking about sanitation solutions in different contexts, both over time and over space, and try to make the argument that while sanitation is a universal right, the route to it is not. This is where the kind of claim, the right to city life, has to be, I guess, understood as a claim. You know, so I'm not, you know, there is no legal provision for the right to city life. I mean, there are kind of, obviously, we can talk about the UN You can talk about rights in relation to UN documentation, in relation to national citizenship provisions, constitutional provisions, and so on and so forth. But in terms of the right to city life, it is an idea derived, obviously, as you pointed out, from in particular from Henri Lefebvre's work, to try to think about the reproduction of the city in a way which centralizes people's needs and aspirations, and redistributes money, resources, and expertise through that kind of lens. It's quite a radical demand on cities. That is not a legal framework. It cannot be reduced to a legal framework. It may include law and legal change, but it can't be reduced to it. It is a claim in that sense. It has no basis other than as a claim. It's a human appeal, I suppose, and this is probably is a Western construction of the notion of the human. It's an ethical imperative. It's an argument for a certain kind of togetherness in the city. Now, where does it come from then, this claim? So for me, it's tied very intimately to the notion of city life. And I think this came up in both your comments, because I think of city life as inherently about interdependence. This is why the book goes through, people, things, infrastructure, microbes, all kinds of non-human worlds as well as human worlds, in trying to make the argument it makes. City life is about interdependence. It cannot be understood outside of interdependence. Maybe one way to illustrate this is the quote that Julia had from her colleague in Mozambique: "I'm going to go and do what no one else can do for me," which is a great line, but it's also quite an individualizing line. Of course, it reproduces the imaginary that sanitation is something we do on our own. And that's kind of, in a sense, that's the great lie of sanitation. It's never been something we do on our own. We do it in private. That's a different thing from saying we do it on our own. Whenever we use a toilet, whenever we flush a toilet, we are calling into being a whole range of infrastructures and people and resources and histories, to paraphrase that kind of famous quote from Slavoj Žižek about flushing the toilet, putting you in the centre of ideology. Equally, in that case in Mozambique, if you're going somewhere, for example, if you're going somewhere which hasn't got a toilet and you're using a local field or wherever it might be, the waste, of course, collectively over time will seep into the water supplies, the agricultural systems. People may have to deal with it. Animals may have to deal with it. Other aspects of the urban or rural environment will have to engage with it. So it's always collective in whatever context, inevitably so. And this is how I think about city life, right? So city life is inherently collective. It involves all kinds of interdependencies, human and non-human, present and historical. And therefore, the right to city life is also itself always a collective claim. So the question of where it comes from, the right to city life, it comes from a view that we are always inherently entwined with one another, other people and other things, human and non-human, animals, infrastructures, resources. So sanitation, even when it's off-grid, is a collective act. And the right to it is collective. The demand for sanitation takes place in a context which is already shared. It's always already a shared activity. So this is partly where I'm coming from, right to city life, which I think is slightly different from the Western tradition of human rights and rights, which is much more about recognizing individuals or a certain form of recognition of certain kinds of individuals, which is subject to contestation and debate and discussion and changes over time, but is an individualizing view. Whereas I think with the right to city life, I'm trying to get to something which is inherently always already collective and to write a kind of vision of sanitation and solutions to it from that position. Now, I don't think, looking over the discussion at the start of the book on the right to city life, I don't think I really outline that maybe in as much detail as I would like. I pass over that quite quickly, so that's maybe partly where some of those questions I think come from. You are in a difficult position when you talk about rights at all, because you always bring with it the baggage of kind of Western institutional debates, which can be themselves and have been shown to be quite violent in terms of what they recognise as human and as a right. So I'm aware of that kind of notion. History and the politics around it. So moving quickly on, because I'm aware of time, maybe we can come back to that. Paying for toilets. The book is a bit negative about the whole idea of pay for toilets. And that's primarily a consequence of trying to make a kind of coherent argument for public kind of ownership of sanitation, which derives again from the what I was just saying about the kind of this vision of city life as these kind of interdependencies and the right to it as a kind of echo of that vision of city life. I try in places in the book, for example, when I talk about utilities and the provision of infrastructures like sewage infrastructures, I try to talk about, you know, we've got to confront the realistic political economies that a lot of countries are operating in, where there just isn't the resource oftentimes to build and maintain public toilets, individual or collective toilet blocks. There just isn't the money to do that in some contexts, or at least it would require quite a shift in a kind of radical shift in political economy to get there over perhaps a period of decades. So I talk about kind of interim solutions and the book doesn't quite make an anti kind of an argument which takes a counter position, you know, sort of to court to private money, whether it's customers or private sector investment. I don't argue carte blanche against that, but I am trying to make an argument for the publicness of the right to city life, which I think derives from how I'm thinking about city life and rights. So I think it's important to say that there are lots of places where actually paying for toilets works really well. And the book could maybe have been a little bit more attentive to those success stories, because they do work very well in many places. I've seen that myself in my own work. But there is an argument, for example, in the UK context, which has been made increasingly over recent decades, that actually what should be happening is that private companies, private establishments, shops, cafes, restaurants, workplaces, offices, and so on, should be legally required to open their toilets to the public. That should be a kind of legal requirement. As a kind of act of desperation, it comes back to what we were saying about waiting. You know, on the one hand, you've got people waiting for access to better sanitation provisions, whether you're walking through the streets of central London or Lagos or Mumbai. On the other hand, you have the urgency of having to meet a bodily needs, which for, as I tried to document in the book, which for, you know, for millions of people, due to medical conditions or indeed other reasons, it has to happen. You know, it's not negotiable. It's not a question of holding it in till you get to wherever, or using the local Starbucks as so many city authorities were recommending during COVID and so on. So it's trying to recognise that, you know, the urgency there, the failure of the state, and some people have said, well, actually, we should be turning to the private sector and just making them do it. Just making them provide it. I'm very sympathetic to that argument. What I'm worried about with that argument is it takes the public responsibility for sanitation slightly off the table. So in the UK context, you know, massive collapse in the provision of public toilets. If we do go down the kind of open up private companies, you know, more widely to general public, not just people with, say, certain medical conditions, but to the general public, then I think we could be in a position where we're sort of taking it off the table completely. Maybe it is already off the table in some people's views, but I would resist that. If you have certain conditions, say Crohn's or colitis, for example, you can get a card in the UK, which means that private companies are supposed to open their toilet to you, not just their employees. So this would be a vision of a more generalised version of that. And I have some sympathy for that. Moving on just quickly, I think the question about space is really important. Who is thinking about sanitation without recourse to space? Well, I think that's the thing that I find kind of astounding about reading a lot of the book. I try to be as interdisciplinary as I can. I'm not necessarily, you know, doing that brilliantly well, but I'm trying to read across different disciplines. And I read quite a lot of stuff from certain strands of, by no means all strands of economics or engineering, for instance, or even around, say, epidemiology, where the lack of attention to spatial difference is quite striking. And so it's sort of a rather straightforward argument, I suppose, for recognising that the geography of sort of inadequate infrastructure, let's say broken pipes or drains, or just where the pipes go you know, how the pressure works in water pipes, where the drains drain into, the impact on the local soil supply, local soil or water supply systems. Like, that basic geography is not actually very well read at local level. It might be understood at kind of more city-wide level to be a problem, but an understanding of what it does to a particular neighbourhood or a particular community within a particular neighbourhood is often lacking. So that has quite significant consequences. So you could say, well, you know, not every city is able to understand the spatial variation of infrastructure, communities, and their needs and aspirations across an entire city. Fair enough. But without that kind of commitment to localized learning within a municipal setup on urban sanitation, and over the longer term, the problems tend to reproduce themselves. So solutions tend to be put in place which are not well adjusted to the needs of a local environment. I mean, just in a very mundane way. Some of Kathleen O'Reilly's work, for example, in India, she's shown how sometimes slapdash, maybe that's a bit harsh, but hurried interventions, sanitation interventions, end up doing things like locating public toilets in areas where women will not use them. So men will use them, but women won't, for reasons of safety or to do with the religious composition of that particular neighbourhood and so on and so forth. Just kind of basic reading of place. You know, being, without that, a kind of solution in the longer term can become either partial or fail. So it's a kind of false economy is what I'm trying to suggest of not reading space. So that I think is probably where I'm coming from, sort of the kind of learning space, basically. I'm aware of time, so I'll just say quickly, what would the book would have looked like if it was more intersectional? Chapter 2, which is on people, goes through a series of different groups, you know, refugees, women, children. It tends to kind of like list different kind of character features. And I was a bit sort of reluctant to do it that way in some ways, because it can become quite clunky and it can undermine a more intersectional story. So I try as I go through that chapter and some of the other chapters to kind of point out, I mean, if you take the right to pee movement in Mumbai, for example, which I mentioned, which is a lot of, you know, it has a lot to do with public sanitation and the experience of women and girls. One of the things they've found time and time again is that the difference that the sort of more middle-class women from certain caste and religious backgrounds have of Mumbai's public toilets is radically different from a working-class woman from a different caste and religious background or religious background in a different part of the city, or even maybe even in the same part of the city. Greater kind of nuancing around sort of the intersectional elements of the sanitation experience. I mean, probably would have enriched some of the descriptions. I think the cost might have been just not flagging up what I was seeing as some of the key recurring concerns around how certain kinds of people tend to suffer more than others. But I'm not sure. I'd be interested to hear more about that. Just the very last point that I'll make, I mean, I really loved Julia's question about, can you think about a sort of networked version of kind of the social justice angle for the right to city life? I think that's really, really important. The sort of network nature of social justice. So I talk a lot in the book about the network nature of sanitation, how sanitation spills over into multiple social and material domains and urban domains. I don't talk about the network nature of kind of activist or community-based movements in response to it, or social justice itself, right, as an idea in this context. I talk much more about the right to city life. So I think movements like, you mentioned Slum Dwellers International, I think they do offer maybe a template here, because one of the things they try to do, and of course, you know, we know there's a lot of debate around Slum Dwellers International, but one of the things they do have always done remarkably well is bring people across different spaces nationally and globally to try to learn from one another about really mundane things like how to maintain toilet infrastructures, how to lobby with the state, how to build trust with municipal officials, how to document problems with sanitation provisions. So you get this kind of learning around the social, material, political potentials of better sanitation, which is attentive to its network nature. I think that's a pretty good example. I'd be curious to know, though, if you guys have other examples that you maybe have in mind, Julia or Vanessa, that they would speak better to, you know, kind of activism or community organization, perhaps on the Overdue Project, which responds to kind of the network nature of sanitation and offers a kind of like, you know, vision for that in terms of social justice. I'd be curious to hear more about that. So I don't think I've covered enough of what you both said here. I've got a lot of notes here, but I think I better stop talking, Nathan, because I've been on for a while here.
No, thanks, Colin. I mean, one could listen to you for hours, no? It was so interesting. Julia, Vanessa, do you have any comments, any questions?
I can come back on that point on the, thank you, Colin. That was really nice and generous engagement with all our questions and our views. And I found that really illuminating. It's not that any of my questions were like not adequately receiving the book, but it's just like whether you could maybe push the argument somewhere. And that's really the case with intersectionality. I mean, intersectionality, I don't think, I'm still to read a really good analysis of intersectional analysis of infrastructures. I hate to say when something, this is still early days or the field is not developed. But I think in this case, because of the very theoretical debates around the notion of intersectionality, it has been really difficult to develop good analysis. And actually, Julia, it'll be really nice if you can give us some insight from Overdue, because I think Overdue was deliberately feminist. I'm not sure if it was also deliberately intersectional. I think it was from what I've heard Julian talking about, but I'm not 100% sure. But the question I wanted to come in is the question of rights and whether we should use the language of rights or should we not use. And of course, coming to the, in 2016, the Habitat 3 conference and the new urban agenda, it was a massive discussion about whether the right to the city was the right language to address some of the issues in our contemporary cities. I'm not sure if you know, but some of the biggest losers of that new urban agenda, so on the one hand, the new urban agenda was relatively progressive compared with other approaches to the city that were around that time and also that you see now. But some of the biggest losers, for example, from those discussions were people who were LGBTIQ+, whose rights were really not recognized. So there was all this talk about the right to the city, but actually the LGBTIQ+ issues were totally excluded from the new urban agenda. I find that really interesting how that discourse. But when you go to thinking about providing services in practice, I'm always like feeling like the rights discourse raises a contradiction, because on the one hand, it gives you these kind of theoretical constraints about, taking recourse on legalistic approaches that really come with Western traditions, whether they are more codified traditions from Roman law or more like Anglophone traditions and so on. But it really goes down to what you were saying, very individualist approaches. And it makes you feel the discomfort of using that language. But on the other hand, and I think your book shows this, it may be working. It may be that language is appropriated. For example, away from the idea of sanitation, the language of rights sometimes seems to work for the right to housing. And I'm here, for example, thinking about a recent analysis of how the right to housing has been applied in South Africa. I'm not an expert on the matter. I've only read other academic work on the matter, but it's really convincing that the right to housing has actually facilitated access to housing to the most marginalized sectors of the population. And the example of South Africa is now being emulated in current housing policy in Namibia, so that different people are trying to learn across different contexts. But as when we are thinking about infrastructure and facilitating city life, we are always faced with these more utopian views about what a just future would look like. If that could be what does an utopian view of the city, but let's remember that those utopias are often justifications for really repressive policies. So I'm always a little bit wary also, like, of putting this long-term perspective and the more intermediary steps. The kind of debates, more progressive debates on ideas of climate resilient development and climate compatible development that Julia is engaging with are an example of this. So a lot of people are just saying, well, we are going to face these enormous risks of climate change. So how do we manage this? How do we go step by step? What are the places where we can do something and we can intervene? For example, we have a project now with, it's called Rurbanize, and it's called Rurbanize because it's in the Philippines, and there in the Philippines is a very good example of a place where the rural and the urban merge in different forms of settlement, which are really fascinating, and that face the risks of climate change in different ways. And sanitation is, as you say in the book, central to all the struggles of climate change, because sanitation relates to the emissions. You explained that very well, but also sanitation is one of the main factors that determines the vulnerability of a particular neighborhood or a particular place to resist the climate change impacts, particularly flooding. But you could argue those relationships exist with other impacts of climate change. So it's closely embedded. So we work there with 9 communities in informal settlements. And in the Philippines, the work is led by the Philippines Alliance, which is the umbrella organization that organizes the Homeless People's Federation of the Philippines. It will be your equivalent to SDI in the Philippines. And one of the hypotheses, so the project has different hypotheses about the distribution of risks in urban environments and also about the possibility to create a structural change by intervening in the political system, a lot building on the work of Jordan Aramayo. But it also has an hypothesis about the fact that a lot of responses to climate change in sanitation and infrastructures are going to emerge within the communities through initiatives for co-design. So that you give some access to some small resources. And there are already ongoing examples that the ASEAN Coalition of Housing Rights has promoted in the Philippines about creating community toilets that are maintained by the communities themselves, for example. That was one of the examples I was thinking of before. Yeah, so what you say is that this kind of provisional kind of way in which we continue to live the city. And I think if you ask people like Malik Simon, they will see that provisional as definitive, as the actual way in which we inhabit the messiness. And wait a minute, because I had a quote from you, which I really like. You say, it is such a dry word, sanitation, curiously itself empty of the messy lived realities of human waste and the tragedies that surround it. When you say the messy lived realities of urban existence, of living together, because what is not messy about being in a city? Obviously, the way we poo is very messy, but also a lot of other things in our life become messy. The mobility, traffic, the way we relate to energy, the way we organize public space, and the ambiguous roles that the pub plays, bringing the community together and also creating other kinds of problems, other kinds of advantages. So, like, life is characterized by that kind of messiness that is never totally resolved. Do we have to get away with these utopias of the right to sanitation or something? Well, perhaps not, because they provide you with that engine, that impulse to actually not get yourself paralyzed and start to wait for somebody else, not just to give you the solution to your problem, but also to give meaning to your life, which is, I think, what Waiting for Godot is about. It's like these guys are waiting to have meaning, to justify their own existence, you know? So these communities are beyond that. They know they want to reaffirm their existence. They want to reaffirm themselves. They wanted to, I mean, these communities, I'm talking like if there's like one homogeneous, but the examples that I know is like people want to be recognized as living lives full of meaning and lies full of importance in their own terms. And I really love that. And I really like that, how it comes across in your book.
I mean, that would have been wonderful closing words, but I'm just going to take a couple of minutes to go into the question of like the feminist lens and it and the intersectional lens, because I think there is a rich body of appearances and more writing also on them emerging, perhaps not in the traditional academic formats that we're looking for, but I think in many other ways, and perhaps we can put some of the overdue resources for that into the podcast notes. So just to signpost, I think what we could find with the feminist lens, I was just looking at when the overdue project started, Beira had 90% of the population off-grid and 10% connected. Sierra Leone Freetown had 0.3% of the population connected, and 75% of its population with completely unimproved peat latrines. And Mwanza had only 23% of the population connected. And with that, what I'm saying is that I think the project departed very much from the realities of what goes on when our idea of the toilet, the grid, is just not there and is not going to be an option for the next years to come. This project and through its approach was traveling through the sanitation service chain. So really from, you know, the beginning of what do you do when you don't have a toilet? Who is going to do all the sanitation work? Looking specifically at, you know, the labor of women at home and the gendered notions of sanitation labor. So that idea also of bodies as infrastructure, right? And perhaps, Colin, in your third chapter, you would have had a sub-chapter on like buckets, bleach and brooms rather than sewers and pipes, I think, if you would have had a sanitation lens. And then traveling through that sanitation service chain to see, like, you know, where does all the fecal sludge, where does it go? You start thinking about, like, is there any value that is being created as this process is going on? Who is working on that? What is the gender dimension of that labor? And we see oftentimes that if there is value created, and I think Colin, you had in that book some examples of biogas, of fertilizers, of things that are being experimented with, it tends to be men who are occupying those increasingly paid, increasingly formal roles in the sanitation service chain. So those are just like, if you were looking through, of a labor lens and a gendered labor lens, things that you might uncover if you take on a feminist lens. Then also questions of maintenance, which I think we haven't discussed today yet, but which I think is critical in discussion. So many toilets have been built, so many toilets have decayed because the international organizations have not thought about who is going to take care of them in a literal sense. And then, you know, again, the question is who gets to decide payment structures? Who is buying the soap? Who is buying the cleaning liquids? Is it the state? Is it the local government? Is it a caretaking group? Is it a caretaker individual? Etc. Where those toilets are located, the question of space is coming back. What do we do with where a lot of women are working, say markets and public toilets? If those women, as in the case of Beira, a lot of the market vendors have been coming from rural areas, so they have been sleeping in the markets during the week while they were working. So the toilet was the only toilet they had. It was not about going home after work, trying not to go to the toilet during the day, but then you go home and you go to the toilet in your neighborhood. But it was about public market toilets becoming a lifeline, becoming a facility that is critical for 24/7, basically, for a certain time. So all those, I think, are just teasers of things that might come through with a feminist lens.
Thanks. Any final words, Colin?
Thank you, both of you, for those. I think it's really important. I think that those last points in particular, just a reminder that this idea that the whole question of sanitation and sanitation provision is such a kind of dynamic one, in the sense that, you know, you have circumstances as different as that. You have men, you know, men disproportionately populating labor opportunities. You have women sleeping in markets, having to use that toilet as their only option. Understanding space and the different kinds of challenges that sanitation continually throws up is really important for any coherent solution, which is so demanding because it requires quite a lot of resource and attentiveness to the city and care and targeted interventions, which themselves might change shape over time as social and economic conditions change. So it's never a fixed thing. And this is one of the arguments I try to sort of making the book, the right to city life is never finished. It's never a point you sort of arrive at. It's always a postponed horizon. And I think this comes back to the points you were making, Vanessa, around the kind of sort of the sense of a sort of end game or a kind of vision down the road that we're trying to get to, a bigger project with interim solutions on the way to bigger provisions or better provisions. I think for most people, probably a lot of the time, my hunch is that that's kind of inevitable. There is some sense of the horizon of what would be a better set of conditions, you know, what would be a better set of toilet provisions for me now in my life circumstance, with how I work, with my family, with my friends in this neighborhood. It may not be well articulated. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. But that sense of a kind of horizon, I think, is there for a lot of people. Certainly not, I mean, that's my hunch. I mean, certainly you mentioned Abdelmalek Simon's work. And one of the things that he has shown, of course, in his work is that people often don't make plans and try to keep their eyes and ears open for possibilities as they emerge and look to what to use, what to avoid according to circumstance, in that sense of a kind of sort of trajectory or a kind of linearity of the future isn't necessarily there. But I'm not sure how widespread that kind of mode of inhabiting urbanism is. These are very varied questions and are difficult questions to know the answers to. But I think there's a sense of that horizon for the question of sanitation as a set of problems and solutions. It has to be, always will be. I mean, you mentioned some of the consequences of the new urban agenda and the way in which that debate took shape and the implications for different groups. You know, it's always an ever-expanding set of questions and agendas that sanitation gets pulled, like other urban questions, I suppose. But sanitation, I think, in particular, gets pulled into, because it's so visceral, because there's so much social and emotional labour attached to it, and because the relations people have with it is so incredibly varied across the course of even an individual's life, you know, from school to work to elderly life where mobility is different. It has this inherent quality of an ever-expanding kind of horizon, always out of reach. And so I think that kind of speaks a little bit to both your sort of comments. But I mean, I take the reflections from Overdue. I mean, I think they're so important. The issues around maintenance are so important. Questions of responsibility, who's responsible for what? You know, it's quite often, as you know, Julia, it's quite often maintenance, which is a bigger problem than provision. You know, you can build a nice shiny toilet block that 2 years down the line is no longer functioning. We see that all over the urban world. I mean, I tried to document some of this in the book, but there are places where, you know, millions of dollars of sanitation investment has disappeared over a period of years. All kinds of reasons for that, social, material, and otherwise, absolutely by no means the fault of the communities, as we sometimes hear. These are complicated questions. But one of the issues is who's responsible for what? And you know, we found that in some of our own work in relation to sanitation in different places as well. No, I think, well, I'd rather pass over to my colleagues if they've got other issues to flag up, or whether we want to, I mean, there's so many other issues. We talked about climate change, and that's a feature which is kind of half in the book. We talked about messiness. I think there's a lot to say about messiness and cities. There's a lot of different themes that we got through in the original presentations, but I don't know if there's anything else, I don't know, a last thought or reflection that Vanessa or Julia has that we want to end on, or?
I think that would be great if you have some final thoughts, Vanessa and Julia.
So maybe just to bring the conversation to another direction that we haven't touched, perhaps. I really like the one comment that Julia made about the book, which is about the connection between this kind of global massive debate that is almost like like the global sanitation crisis, like almost you cannot apprehend it in your mind. And particularly when you see all those statistics and figures that Colin cites, I mean, like there's a part of the book which every paragraph is like, really? 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 And even though you know it, it's like it feels emotionally, it feels hard. But with that contrast between that and the journey that Colin makes into different kind of institutions, different kind of bodies, different kind of networks, meaning institutional networks, not just like the more broad network of sanitation, and down to communities and individuals and individual experiences. So I like that this idea of how these politics of sanitation cross across the scales, and exactly what Julia was saying, that it cuts across all levels of institutional thinking about the city and politics, and also that engages with different levels of learning and different ways the cities learn for progressive or unprogressive means, because learning is not necessarily inherently positive. Sometimes we learn to harm. So I found that really interesting that Julia made that point, and that it's also a running theme in the book about how these politics play in these different constructed levels, different ways in which we look at the problem of sanitation, and therefore conceptualize sanitation as something different and extractive from that spatial context and from that network that Colin situates it back in.
And perhaps just a final word on the messiness, because it's a subject that I find very, very attractive as well. The overdue team recently wrote a blog after visiting the Tamil Nadu sanitation support program in Tichy, and they were looking at different fecal sludge treatment plans, and we're looking also at the whole NIMBYism that you think might come with that, no? Like having a fecal sludge treatment plant in your backyard, would you want that? Would you want the smell? Would you want the noise? Would you want the people around you? You know, like all that kind of stigma, and they're doing wonderful work in terms of confronting it. And perhaps, Colin, that gets back to your question of like examples of where collectives have really managed to leverage the discussion and overcome a lot of the stigma that comes with sanitation work. That is a blog post that goes from, really just bit by bit, just saying, no, it is not as messy as you think it is. You perhaps wouldn't even notice if you would know what is going on here. Do you see those flowers here? They're helping so that there is less nitrate as an output, etc. So I think it is important also, with all the messiness that we kind of conjure up in our heads when we think about sanitation, to also look for those spaces where we actually have to say, like, well, but actually, not all is messy. And it makes sense for you. And that perhaps comes also back to the question of land, of space, of where do we have all those sanitation facilities, to rethink what are the images that we're having in our head, and what are the kind of assumptions that we're carrying with us when we're thinking about sanitation, how it is practiced, and how infrastructures are being built.
Thank you both. I completely agree. I mean, I think just on the point between the kind of, on the one hand, you've got these global debates around sanitation with all the kind of statistics, which are kind of difficult to fathom, as you say, and then there are kind of all these more individual or community institutional contexts and stories, and you know, that was quite a tricky thing to do. I mean, just in terms of the writing of the book, I tried not to have a particular sort of scale of analysis, in the sense that, you know, there's lots of reports on sort of on the kind of global statistics around sanitation, which kind of might have the odd case study, but they're largely global. And then there's lots of case studies of sanitation in particular places. And I was trying to find some kind of register sort of, in between that, if that's not too crude a way to describe it, that was finding, recurring problem spaces through which to think about sanitation in relation to whatever it might be, drainage, utilities, the experience of women in particular, and so on and so forth. Like, trying to identify what I was seeing, at least through my own research, but also through the stuff I've read over the years, as kind of some of the recurring kind of centers of gravity around the global sort of urban sanitation crisis, and then from there to kind of write both up and down, you know, up into some of the global stats and policy pronouncements, and sort of down into local context, if I can use that kind of vertical kind of imaginary, which is not necessarily particularly satisfactory, but hopefully, I suppose, you know, a kind of mid-level form of analysis, to use a phrase which sometimes gets used in relation to this kind of writing, which is a bit different from me, from some of my previous work. And so, but I found that to be perhaps the more useful way to kind of capture some of the local geographical problems, whilst not losing sight of the kind of larger global story that I was trying to tell. But there's probably more to say about that in terms of modes of writing and ways of expressing particular problems. On the kind of the example you were just describing, Julia, around Tamil Nadu, it's interesting because I think the question of, I mean, it sounds like I would like to read the blog that you mentioned, and I think that the question of messiness in relation to sanitation is quite interesting because there's obviously the kind of sensorial bodily dimensions of mess, which becomes often attached to, as Vanessa was saying, to questions of shame, humiliation, blame, kind of blur the private, the bodily, and the public in all kinds of ways. And also to labor, you know, manual scavenging and so on and so forth. And so there's a kind of bodily question of mess, but there's also a kind of more fundamental kind of baggage that comes with the category of sanitation, which is to do with, goes back to that, I think it was Vanessa who was talking about that when I talk in the book about sanitation as a curiously dry term. I think that's where the term messiness maybe comes up in the book. Because sanitation as a term is very linked to particular visions of urban modernity, particular visions of a circulatory infrastructural system, and notions of the city as contained and containing its wastes, processing it, cleaning things, removing waste out of sight beyond the sensorial realm, cleaning up the waste and bringing things back into the city, this kind of circulatory image. And that brings with it a kind of anti-messiness, that inheritance of thinking about sanitation through urban modernity, to the point where writing the book, I started to wonder if I should try to find an alternative term to sanitation itself. Because if rights is a term that carries with it a certain Western individualizing lineage, sanitation is also a term that carries with it a particular Western vision of modernity, urban modernity, which also became a colonial project. You know, it became a deeply kind of dispossessing, subjugating colonial logic. How do we sanitize the colonies? That kind of that rhetoric that we, both the colonies actually also in relation to class in the metropole as well. And so I was kind of a bit, I had a moment of wondering whether I should try not to use the term, or whether there was a better way of describing what this thing is, sanitation, right? Because it is multiple different things, you know? So the messiness for me is the radical kind of instability of the concept itself, right? Sanitation itself. And indeed, city life. You know, these are concepts which are sort of like excessive concepts. They're always multiplying new relations. They both feel important concepts to me, like sanitation and city life. They feel important to me. I feel like there's stakes attached to them, but I also feel that they're ungraspable. Like, you know, they're kind of impossible concepts. How do you know? Because there's always more in the jar. I have a sort of discomfort with the term sanitation because of that urban modernity heritage. Can you reinvent that concept, that idea, or are you sort of stuck with that? So that's where the question of messiness, I think, becomes for me a particular kind of problem. You know, it's not necessarily the messiness of wastes and bodies and all that, and although I think that's important in terms of the politics and the experience. It's much more about that kind of vision of and that inheritance. And I don't know whether that lands with either of you in terms of thinking about this problem of sanitation or whether you see it differently, but I'm sort of, it's in the back of my mind a lot.
Actually, when just writing this little introduction, I was thinking exactly about that. Maybe from another perspective, it was more about what is really sanitation? Because I was going to write the sentence as Colin engages with this global problem of, and I wanted to say of what? Of toilets, pipes, and reservoirs, and other infrastructures. But yeah, that's what you say. Then that reduces what is a very complex issue to a modernity project, a modernization project, and also one that is linked to the disciplining of the body and the creation of different forms of disposability and disposable bodies. And what is dirty? So like, what is dirty in the city? What is not? What areas are dirty? What areas are not dirty? But also, who is dirty and who is not dirty? And then the other thing is like in the book you show that okay, this core of sanitation that you've just landed in for clarity, not for theoretical coherence, let's say, also relates to is what you say dynamic is ever expanding subject. So you get it into trickling into what it means to have a family, and or trickling into what it means to access education. For example, one topic you don't raise is the relationship between sanitation and sexuality, and like all the things that we don't dare to talk about, they remain under this cover of sanitation, and under this cover of the place where our more intimate persona connects with the society we live in and the kind of collective connections that we have. So I totally share your discomfort. But I mean, we should be discomfort. We should feel that discomfort almost about every word that we use in the world. So I don't think that's a problem for writing a book, but I think it is a problem more generally for continuing the debate.
Thank you. Thanks. I feel that's a good point to end with. So maybe I bring this to a close. So thanks a lot for joining, and thanks for listening to this episode.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website, urbanpolitical.podigy.io.
Please subscribe and follow us on Twitter.